the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Alan Dean Foster is my guest. He's a prolific science fiction writer whose most recent work is on the top of the New York Times bestseller list. It's called Star Wars: The Force Awakens. Alan Dean Foster, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So the top of the bestseller list, that's pretty cool. What does that feel like?
It's Star Wars. It's not me. I like to think that, you know, after doing these things for so many years, maybe I add a little bit to it. Maybe it helps it be number one instead of number four or something, but I don't flatter myself that it's an original work. It's you know, Star Wars by, it's not me doing something else. But still, it's nice. It's always good to see your name up there, and I try to do the best I can with these assignments and give the fans their money's worth within the restrictions that are placed on me these days. There didn't used to be such restrictions, but the Internet has changed things.
How has the Internet changed things?
Well, when I started doing novelizations back in 1973, in the absence of the Internet or anything even vaguely like it, it wasn't a problem, for example, for a studio to send me a screenplay to novelize with some pre-production drawings and maybe some stills from the production, and I would go ahead and do it and send it off to the publisher, and the publisher would have the manuscript sitting around their office for as long as was necessary, and then they would issue the book. Nowadays, if you tried something like that, somebody in the publishing office or the post office or UPS or FedEx would intercept the script before it even got to me, let alone before the book was done, and in 24 hours everybody on the planet would know the whole story.
Oh.
So the studios are understandably...
they're more nervous now.
Paranoid is the word you're looking for. And, you know, with good reason. If you're spending nine figures on a film, you don't want everybody to know everything about the film before the film is released. Also, back in those days, ongoing franchises weren't so much of a thing. Star Trek, Star Wars, Alien, the idea that you were going to make episodes 2 and 3 and 4 and so on into the future. And when I talk about restrictions from a story point, and this has come up with The Force Awakens, readers say, understandably, well, it's interesting that you give us this little bit of information about Rey or this little information about Poe Dameron or Finn. Why can't we have more? We need to know the answers to these questions. And sometimes I would try to do that, and the story group would say, we're actually kind of trying to hold on to that for episode 8 or episode 9. Or perhaps episode 23, who knows? The idea is that if you have an ongoing franchise, you can't give everything away in the current film, or you have no ongoing franchise.
Right, right. And you've been involved with Star Wars since the very beginning. In fact, before the beginning, because your first Star Wars book came out before the first film. How did you first get involved in Star Wars?
I had done a couple of novelizations for Random House Del Rey, and had then embarked on novelizing all of the Saturday morning animated Star Trek shows. And in the course of that, someone perhaps saw that. I had heard that someone connected with Star Wars had read a book of mine called Ice Rigger, which was my third original novel. And even though it doesn't duplicate in any way the plot of Star Wars, it was felt that it was similar in spirit to what George Lucas was doing with the film, and that perhaps, given all of those factors, I might be the right person to make a book out of the film and also to write a sequel book, since that was the idea from the very beginning. I then went and met with George's lawyer, Tom Pollack, later to become CEO of Universal Studios, but at that time George's and many other people's lawyer, and was vetted, I presume, and since I didn't show up with a bloody axe on my shoulder and a mask over my face, I guess they thought I passed that part, and I went out to Industrial Light and Magic, which at that time was in a rented warehouse on Kester Avenue in Van Nuys, in part of Los Angeles, and met a bunch of people, and George and I had a nice chat, and then it was go off and write the book.
Just like that.
Just like that.
And there, in your first Star Wars novel, which was called Star Wars, that was before they had all the episode this and that, but actually it had a subtitle, Star Wars from the Notebooks of...
The Adventures of Luke Skywalker.
Skywalker.
Yeah. And you have a lot of scenes and even characters that aren't in the movie. Were those your inventions? Were they in the original screenplay?
Some were in the original. Well, some were in the screenplay that I was given. Mm-hmm. And some things I came up with myself, sometimes just for fun. When you're doing a novelization, you really want, if you're a responsible writer, you want to give the reader as much original material as you can. Otherwise, you might as well just print the screenplay. And you can go buy screenplays, too, and they don't make for very good, relaxing reading. And sometimes I'm allowed to add stuff, as I mentioned in the case of The Force Awakens, and sometimes not. Not only because the filmmakers and the studio might want to develop characters and situations further in future chapters of the franchise, but also because they don't, you know, you might find yourself contradicting something that hasn't even shown up yet.
Right.
If you describe a character as right-handed, for example, something as simple as that, and there is a specific reason that the studio and the filmmakers already have in mind for episode 10, let's say, where the character is left-handed, then you have to change that in your existing book, even though that hasn't become an issue yet.
So how far in advance of Star Wars The Force Awakens release did you have a screenplay and did you have time to work on the novel? I mean, you couldn't have written that novel in a day. It took you a while to write it.
It took about 6 weeks.
Uh-huh. So was the film already completed before you got to write it?
No, it wasn't. It was still... Nowadays, films can go into post-production almost right up until the date of release because everything is done digitally, uh-huh, and the film is distributed digitally. In the old days, you had to strike prints one after another. It was an arduous mechanical process, and the film would always be finished a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times, before I finished the book. That didn't mean I got to see the film. But again, many times the film was still in production, and they throw you changes because something has changed in the course of the shooting or in post-production, and you are asked, the request is made, to please incorporate the change in the book. And since publishers have earlier deadlines, at least those who are still doing print, than the filmmakers do now, it used to be the other way around, but now it's the publishers who, you know, you have to get the book proofread and copy edited and printed and a cover made and bound and put in trucks and shipped to bookstores. They don't have nearly as much time to play with it up to the last minute as the filmmakers do. So that's why sometimes when something like the novelization of The Force Awakens comes out, and something in the book contradicts something you see in the film, it's very often because the film has been changed after the manuscript for the book has been turned in, and there's just nothing can be done about that. The worst example of that, at least in my personal instance, was the novelization I did of Terminator Salvation, where basically everything was changed at the last minute. And there was literally no way to go back and fix, you know, these couple of pages and those couple of pages. And for the sake of the readers, I didn't have to do this. I had already had the manuscript accepted. But for the sake of the readers, because I'm as much a fan as I am a professional writer, I went back to page one and went through and did a rewrite on the whole book in 2 days.
Wow.
I didn't do much else for 2 days, but I just ethically couldn't let it slide. Because yeah, had I done so, the book would have made no sense to anybody seeing the movie and vice versa.
We're talking with Alan Dean Foster, and he is the prolific science fiction author of the new Star Wars novel, Star Wars: The Force Awakens. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. So you're sort of defying that whole idea. I mean, I enjoy your work, and I enjoy good novelizations by you and other authors, some of whom have been here on From the Bookshelf. And I think there's a sort of an attitude that's like, oh, it's only a novelization. Just put it out there. It's just something to go along with the movie. But you don't feel that way, obviously, or you wouldn't have taken the time with Terminator to really put some work into it. You have faith in your novelizations, that they are works of art?
Well, the writing stands on its own. I've said this over and over again. As I said before, if you take a best-selling novel and you adapt a screenplay from it, and you win an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay, everybody says, oh, what a great piece of writing. But if you take a screenplay and make a novel out of it, which is much more difficult, because I've done both, much harder to do, then suddenly it's hack work. and I think the writing has to stand on its own. There are certainly some really bad novelizations out there, and there are a lot of bad original screenplays out there, too, that have been taken from books.
it cuts
both ways.
Well, you know, I think in general, and I love the movies, but I think most movies are not very good, which is why I was so delighted with Star Wars The Force Awakens. I thought it was a really fine film. I enjoyed it very much. And I was anxious to read your novel, and I was delighted to find scenes in your novel that aren't in the film. And, oh, for instance, how does Poe get off the planet Jakku, or when Rey encounters the junk dealer guy in Maz's cantina. Now, were those scenes in the screenplay, or did you make them up?
Well, again, it's just like, as you mentioned, for the first film, there's a little of both. The sequence involving showing Poe getting off Jakku wasn't in the screenplay. And the word came down, the suggestion from the Star Wars Lucasfilm Story Group, could I please write that? Because evidently a number of people had pointed out that, you know, Poe crash lands and then suddenly he's with the Resistance.
It's kind of a hole in the plot of the movie.
Right, and there's only so much time in a two-hour and 15-minute movie to cover every plot point if you have multiple characters and multiple viewpoints. So upon that request, I put that in there and tried, of course, to make everything blend in with what had gone before and what came after. As far as the sequence in Maz Kanata's castle involving Unkar Plutt trying to mess with Rey and Chewbacca stepping in, that was in the screenplay that I got. Now, whether they took that out because they thought it was too violent, I don't know. You can never please everybody, but the feedback I've gotten on that particular scene or that I've read about it is every fan of the film really likes seeing Chewbacca get into it, as it were. In fact, I get asked from time to time who are my favorite characters to write in writing this novelization, and I loved writing Rey, of course, as the main character, but I particularly liked writing Chewbacca, because Chewbacca actually gets to be a character in this film as opposed to just a special effect.
Yes, more so than in any of the other films.
Absolutely. I mean, he doesn't sit down and start spouting Shakespeare, which would be interesting in the Wookiee language, I suppose.
Well, I love that little scene where he's having his wounds nursed by a nurse, and she's saying, "Oh, you're so brave. That does sound so scary."
Well, those are little touches. That was also in the screenplay, by the way. I didn't come up with that either.
Yeah.
But those little things like that I don't want to say humanize the character, because he's not human, but make the character relatable. You know, it's wonderful when you can do that, particularly with an alien character.
Now, the character of Rey, I don't think there's ever been a character like her she's certainly unique to the Star Wars universe. There's never been a powerful woman whose gender has absolutely nothing to do with it.
Well, if you're referring specifically to science fiction film,
yeah,
there have been, but they're certainly not common. You know, the progenitor, obviously, is Ellen Ripley from the Alien films.
Right, that's true.
Whose character was originally written as a man, by the way.
Ah, but of course, Ripley does take off her clothes at least once in the picture, whereas Rey, you know, throughout the whole movie, she's comfortably dressed.
Well, it's Star Wars. It's not. It's a different rating involved. You know, I make no predictions, but it's obviously, you know, aimed at a different age group.
A great character, though.
Oh, Rey! Rey's a wonderful character. Specifically because, well, not only because of the things you just mentioned, but because we don't know everything about her. If we knew who her parents were, what her full background was, then nobody would be looking forward nearly as much to Chapter 8 and 9, because those are major questions that people are interested in.
You had a difficult scene to write in the book, is in the film when she touches the lightsaber of Luke and she has all these kind of visions. Was that difficult to translate to writing?
Any scene that's purely visual, where there's very little dialogue and where the action doesn't follow, you know, from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, is difficult to write. Anything involving a vision, anything involving a dream sequence, can be very tough to write. It was fairly well spelled out in the script, though, so I didn't have to make a lot up. What's hard to do with scenes like that is to change the tone of the language so that it doesn't sound like descriptions of a desert or descriptions of a forest or descriptions of a room in a castle, but that it has its own sonic individuality, although that sounds pretentious, I suppose. But you want the language to be different than, you know, describing something like that than in describing more solid reality. So yes, in that respect, it was difficult to write, but it was fairly well spelled out in the script.
Now, you've written, as you mentioned earlier, both Star Wars and Star Trek stuff, and you wrote the novelization to the most recent Star Trek films as well, correct?
That's correct.
So can you compare and contrast the two, Star Trek and Star Wars?
Well, they're different universes, and they come from different places. I don't want to say Star Trek is a little more adult than Star Wars, but...
But you just did.
Yes, I did, didn't I? It is. It's a little more science fiction, or tries to be a little more science fiction, than Star Wars. Star Wars is more space opera, let's say, and Star Trek does have occasional touches of what we call hard science fiction. A good way to describe it is Star Wars is set in a galaxy far away, and Star Trek is set in this one. So everything that happens in Star Trek, however far-fetched, has to relate back to humankind on Earth, whereas in Star Wars, you have no such historical baggage to carry around with you.
There's nothing far-fetched in Star Trek. What are you talking about? Well, I always think of it as, I think Star Trek is a more optimistic piece of work, because it's our future in which things are much better. I mean, they may not be better right at that moment for our heroes, but, you know, they've evolved beyond Earth's problems. Whereas Star Wars happened, it's, first of all, it's got war in the title, and it happened in the past. So it seems to me Star Trek is a more optimistic thing.
Well, Star Trek is extrapolating on our present, and Star Wars isn't.
Yeah.
So in addition to restrictions, you know, people like Star Trek because, at least nominally, they try to solve problems without blowing other things up. The problem with that is you end up with a French film. And if everybody just sits around and talks things out, that's the way you want things to go. But it can make for a very dull film.
Yeah.
You know, you end up with My Dinner with Captain Kirk or something. Yeah.
Shatner wouldn't like it if they just sat around and talked. He's going to punch somebody.
No. I think he would like it, actually, if they sat around and talked. I know Bill likes to talk, and he's a good talker. But it makes for a good interview, but it makes for a slow, you know, large-budget franchise feature. And trying to balance the two can be very difficult. I'd like to see, actually, a little more of that balance in the future. I think it's swung a little bit too far over to the let's blow something up. But nobody asks me, so.
Well, they did ask you in the first Star Trek film. You're credited with the story.
That's right. And we did try to do that. But trying to go into a studio these days and say, I'd like to make a 9-figure film about the next step up in human evolution, would be a real tough sell. It'd be like trying to go in and say, let's do Olaf Stapledon's Last and First Men or Star Maker. It's just not going to happen. I was astonished. The only way that's going to happen is if it's done on TV. Mm-hmm. Because too much money is invested in too short a running time for theatrical releases. You need to make a lot of money back very quickly, whereas with television that's not necessary. That's why, after 60-odd years of Childhood's End being under option, it finally got made by the Science Fiction Channel as a 3-part TV series, because that was the only way to do it practically.
I hear Star Trek is coming back to television also. Do you have anything to do with that?
Not so far, but I'm here. I'm here if they want to ask me. If I haven't already put the kibosh on that by saying I'd like to see fewer things blow up and a little more, you know, trying to solve things through reason and logic.
We're talking with Alan Dean Foster, whose latest book is Star Wars, The Force Awakens. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. You mentioned that you're as much a fan as anything else. So you didn't get a chance to see The Force Awakens without knowing everything that was going to happen. So when you first sat down to read the screenplay, could you see it in your mind's eye? Did you think it was a good film?
Oh, yeah. I've always been able to do that. I learned how to read from reading comic books, specifically Karl Barks. So I've always seen things visually, not necessarily in little panels, but there's always been a movie playing in front of my mind's eye whenever I read something, whether it's a screenplay or a book or a short story or whatever. I always see it in visual terms. And as soon as I read the screenplay and got into it, particularly the character of Ray and the character of Finn, I knew that, you know, unless they messed it up, and this being an Abrams picture, I knew that visually it wasn't going to be messed up. I knew that they had done their job, essentially.
A lot of fans feel that this is really a step up from the three films that Lucas made, episodes 1, 2, and 3. Then you have any comment?
You know, it's not my universe, but there's no question that, for better or worse, that The Force Awakens harkens back to the spirit of the first three films. But that's what happens when you start trying to tell an individual story, one person's story, as was the case with episodes 1, 2, and 3, instead of doing a broader, larger canvas. It's a difficult trick to pull off. David Lean did it with Lawrence of Arabia, where essentially you're focused on one person throughout the entire film and telling his story and still having, you know, great spectacle and great adventure. But it's a very, very difficult thing to bring off. You know, different people have different opinions about such things. And as I said, it's not my universe. In the ones that I create in my original works, sometimes I focus on one person and get into their head a lot more, and at other times it's a broader canvas.
I thought of Lawrence of Arabia when I was watching The Force Awakens, not only because there's some scenes set in the desert, and also because the Star Wars theme is so similar to the Lawrence of Arabia theme, just sped up faster. Have you ever noticed that?
No, but it's impossible to watch a science fiction film, I think, without thinking, set in a desert, without thinking of Lawrence of Arabia. At least every once in a while. I mean, we can blame Freddie Fields for that. He was the cinematographer on Lawrence of Arabia.
A brilliant film.
Yeah. In fact, someone once said, "How did you feel about David Lynch's version of Dune?" And the person said, "I've already seen it. It was called Lawrence of Arabia."
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Karl Barks, because earlier when we were talking about novelizations, and I credited you with, you know, not just tossing them off. I mean, that's what Karl Barks did with his work. He didn't just say, "Oh, it's just for kids." His Duck World was extremely well thought out and well planned and researched.
No matter what you're working on, whether it's an original work or a novelization or a spin-off novel, you never talk down to your audience. If you get blowback, as The Force Awakens has gotten sometimes in comments online from people who say, "Well, it was written with a thesaurus at one hand," and it wasn't, by the way. I'm very conscious of that. That's just the language I use. But you never talk down to your audience. Barks never talked down to his audience, even though his audience was kids, basically. And that's why, as an adult, you can still read Karl Barks' Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck comics today and enjoy them, because they weren't written, per se, for kids. Chuck Jones once said the same thing about cartoons. When someone said, "Do you make cartoons for kids?" He said, "No, we and the guys over at Warner make cartoons for ourselves." And the end result is always much more successful than if you say, "I'm going to write this for kids."
Well, Alan Dean Foster, you've written, I don't know, about 600 books. How many books? You've written a lot of books. How many books have you?
125.
Well, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And many of those are originals, and many are based on screenplays or series, things like that. What are you working on now?
Funny you should ask. Right now, I'm finishing up a book called The Director Should Have Shot You, which is a nonfiction book about my history with novelizations.
Wow.
Because I kept getting these questions, and of course, more so since I've done a lot of interviews because of The Force Awakens, and you keep getting asked a lot of the same questions, and you find yourself telling a lot of the same stories, and people seem to find them of interest. And I thought, well, this is history of a sort. I really should get it down so that people, 150 years from now, if somebody is doing an obscure PhD thesis on novelizations of the the late 20th, early 21st century, or whatever they decide to call it, they don't have to go to 433 radio interviews and TV interviews and podcasts and pick one piece from this one and one story from that one. They'll all be in one place. Whether it'll find a publisher or not, I have no idea. But you always got to finish the book first.
Is that true with your science fiction work, too? You finish before you have a publisher, or do you have a publisher waiting for your sci-fi stuff?
Well, it's varied over the years. Sometimes I would have a contract. One time I had a six-book contract with Ace Books for all original material, and at other times there would be something I would really want to write, and I'd just go ahead and write it because I felt the need to write it, like Ocean Earth, which is out now from Wordfire Press. It's a fantasy. It's set entirely underwater, and it took a while to find the right publisher, but I'm glad that's something I wanted to write.
Your work has a, although it's science fiction, it has a relevance to us. You focus a lot on environmental issues and things of that nature.
That's always interested me. That's something I didn't get from Barks, but it's something I got from reading when I first started reading science fiction. And to becoming aware of the world around me, all I ever wanted to do was travel. And that feeling for environmentalism and for taking care of the ship that we're on has only been reinforced by the things that I've seen in the course of my travels.
Do you think your work is political?
Some of it. Not so much as other writers, but every once in a while I'll dip into something, like with a book like The Man Who Used the Universe, which came about because I wondered what would happen if Jesus came back and he was born in, a poor part of town, and he was really ticked off by what he saw, and he didn't really care about saving humankind. He only cared about taking care of himself. So the main character is kind of a messianic character. He has no fantastical abilities, but he's born poor and in desperate circumstances. And everything he does, every time he does something while rising to the top of the heap, both as a criminal and then as a legitimate industrialist, is only for purposes of securing his own well-being. But every time he does something, like, for example, cleaning up the pollution on his home world, he does that because pollution is bad for him to breathe. But everybody thinks he's this wonderful guy because he's gotten rid of pollution. And it's entirely out of self-interest. And in the end, he ends up stopping a potential interstellar war between humanity and an alien species called the Nuul, not because he's some great peacemaker, but because war is bad for business and his own personal health.
Well, people ought to have that point of view, because it is generally bad for most people, except for those people who are selling arms.
Yeah, but people won't say, well, I'm doing this out of self-interest. And what they are doing it out of self-interest, but if they're asked about it, they'll say, well, I'm doing this because I want to save the children or because of some other reason. Not that there aren't people like that. There are, of course. But there are also people who do these things purely for themselves, but they're willing to take credit for doing something good for other people.
Well, Alan Dean Foster, I sure have enjoyed your work, and it's a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
You're most welcome, Gary, anytime.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. That's a good idea. I want to thank my guest, Alan Dean Foster, the great science fiction writer. His most recent book is Star Wars: The Force Awakens. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.